And probably no one at 6:03 in the morning is really into taking down the lyrics and listening to some great, you know, the great philosophical message that is contained therein. So I will explain the song. The song is, of course, about Gaia, who is our Mother Earth. Therein lies the feminist angle, you see. And Gaia, well, actually, she's being talked to. The person doing the talking is a real estate developer. And he is giving her his best lines, his finest shot. He's trying to convince her that he can liberate her by clearing her forests and excavating her. And just, you know, he's her friend. He's her friend until the end of time. And he's a real snake oil salesman. And it's a delightfully cynical song, actually. Very refreshing. So I have it here on cassette, which means I'm going to have to turn around and go clunk. So you will forgive me. And I wanted everyone to hear this just for the sake of its total tongue-in-cheekness. It's really a lot of fun. And because I've been promising the poor man for 3 weeks, pitching, you see, gets in the way. Also, the fact that I'm not here for 2 weeks and I can actually sit and run my mouth for an entire hour with hardly any breaks. These things get in the way when you only have a 2-hour show, but I don't want any more than 2 hours. Believe me, I've had 2.5. It's too long. So without too much further ado, let me get to this wonderful song, which is called Gaia 2. And I say it's on cassette. It's probably not properly cued, and I hope that I've got everything together here in order to let you hear it. So let's do that, shall we? Gaia 2 by a band with migrating names. I think they're tending to call themselves these days the Fiendish Thingies, which is from Help, I believe. Yes, Help. Gaia 2. Gaia 2, boom, by the Fiendish Thingies. And with my debt thoroughly and humbly paid, let me go on, if I possibly can, with a reading from a periodical that I found at my job, my last job, Exploring the World of Women, writing in Holland and Flanders, from 1979. This is a piece called A Wreath for Sylvia. It's written by Ethel Portnoy. It says a short story, but it is an anecdote of something in her life. One of the things I wanted to do here was to show diversity between different ethnic groups, as you will, of women. And the first one was obviously about Chinese and Chinese American women. Chinese women written by a Chinese American woman. And this is about the woman in question is a Jew from Poland. And she's being written about by a woman who I believe was born in the United States and went to live in Holland. This is A Wreath for Sylvia by Ethel Portnoy. By the time I was 8 years old, I knew the meaning of the term common law marriage. I had found it in the legal advice column of a newspaper and realized with great feeling of relief that it applied to the case of my Aunt Sylvia. So there was a name for her sort of setup, too, so even that was orderly, and in its own disorderly way, a part of the world's order. Although no one had actually ever told me that she and Pappas did not have a marriage license kicking around in some bureau drawer, I just knew instinctively that they didn't, being the sort of people they were. And this knowledge would sometimes trouble me because in every other respect my world was tidy, and being a child, I loved it for being like that. But I also knew from very early in my conscious existence that my adored Aunt Sylvia had kept herself outside of that world. She behaved to me not so much as an elder, but as an accomplice, and perhaps the reason I liked her so much was that she refused to play a role in the conspiracy to turn me into a nice Yiddish Mädel. Every family has its black sheep, but in Jewish families it is rare for that sheep to be a girl. There must have been a certain component of virility in my Aunt Sylvia, or was it merely a stubborn desire to do things her own way that led her to reject the feminine role in Jewish culture from the very outset? From the way my mother tells it, one would think she grew up in the country. Actually, when I looked up her birthplace, Lukacs, on an old map of Poland, I discovered that it was not a tiny village as I had imagined, but a small town, a shtetl, to give it the name that anthropologists use to describe such Central European Jewish communities. Others I have met from that place seem to try to perpetuate its bucolic myth. Before she came to America, your mother never wore shoes, an elderly lady once told me. This is odd because my mother's father, when he could spare a moment from studying the Talmud, made a living as a cobbler. But perhaps it is literally true that the shoemaker's children do not wear shoes. I suppose the family must have lived on the outskirts of town where it merged with the open country. Such a setting must have been heaven for my mother's younger sister, my red-headed, freckle-faced Aunt Sylvia. From the moment she appears in the family folklore, it's clear that she is not preparing herself for an ideal Jewish girlhood, as my mother likes to evoke it. Maidens in long white dresses, their arms twined around each other's waists, walking under leafy trees down by the river. A lost world of Arcadian purity. Something is signified by these images. It is virginity. Like timid does, these shy creatures waited patiently to be taken in marriage. In the meantime, they braided each other's hair and helped their mother in the kitchen. I cannot see how my Aunt Sylvia could ever have grown up to fit into such a picture. Her great early passion was the desire to ride a horse. A Polish peasant offered to lend her one. The peasant was malicious. The horse was blind. It galloped off with my Aunt Sylvia and smacked at full speed into a barn door. She spent some weeks in bed after that. By the time Sylvia was 10, the Austrian, White Russian, and Bolshevik cavalry had swept back and forth through Lukacs several times. Each time the family would run into the woods until the army in question had taken the town. When the tumult and the shouting died, they would go back home again. After the war came the famines. These must coincide with my mother's statement. For a long time we had nothing to eat but a few potatoes. It was then that America opened her gates wide to the Jews of Central Europe, and the eldest son of the family, my Uncle Jaime, made his way to New York, found a job, and started sending for his brothers and sisters. My mother was 17 and Sylvia 15 when they set out together to walk the 600 kilometers that separated Lukács from the seaport of Danzig. Now comes a scene of which I am ashamed. Somewhere in the outskirts of Danzig, in a forest, says my mother, stood a tent. A long line of refugees stood in a queue outside it. Seeing the line, my mother and Sylvia committed what my mother describes as a bold deed, an exploit. The girls crawled into the tent from the back and at once wormed their way up to the registration table for visas and tickets. They left on the next ship. If there was punishment for such a deed, my mother's must have come during the long sea crossing from Danzig to Copenhagen, and thence to New York. She lay in the depths of the hold where the immigrants had their bunks, retching until she could retch no more. Sylvia, full of her usual mad enterprise, was of course never sick for a minute. She clambered around the slippery decks in the midst of terrible storms, and the next anecdote about her in our family folklore shows a sailor's gigantic hand in close-up, pulling Sylvia back by her blouse just as she is about to be swept overboard by a huge wave. On Ellis Island, where all immigrants were put ashore, Sylvia, who until then had borne the Hebrew name of Sure, was made into a prospective American by bureaucratic baptism under the name of Sylvia. Bearing this name, she now assumes a shape for me, as a 16-year-old girl on a sepia photograph. As soon as the girls got to New York, Jaime had found jobs for them in the garment industry and a furnished room on the Lower East Side. They registered at night school in order to learn to read and write English, and with their first American dollars to celebrate the beginning of a new life. Mama and Sylvia brought themselves dresses and had their pictures taken. I have Sylvia's picture before me. A buxom girl with a big, fresh, full face, her thick mop of copper-colored curls shaped in front into bangs. She is thrusting out her chin and grinning, and one can see that from some distant ancestor who was surely not in the line of Abraham, Isaac, and Esau, she had inherited the East Baltic profile, the short, rather thick, turned-up nose and somewhat protruding jaw with which we have become familiar in the faces of Russian astronauts. Her dress is something like a sack. It has many small buttons running along the side of the high collar and down one shoulder. Around her waist is a broad sash with fringes. Her plump legs are encased in shiny silk stockings, and her feet are stuffed into high-heeled pumps. My mother married when she was 19. A year after that, these pictures were taken, and the year after that, I was born. I must have been 3 when I finally became fully conscious of the presence of Sylvia as an aunt in my life. Although at the time, and even until I was 20, I thought of all adults as elderly. I realize that now Sylvia must then have been only 21. I don't remember ever having seen her with a man in those early days. She showed no signs of getting married as a young Jewish woman ought to do. I don't think she consciously rebelled. She merely avoided joining the ranks of those faceless slaves who bear children, became fatter with every year, and at last sink self-sacrificingly into the grave. For one thing, she was not getting fatter, but thinner. She had taken up cigarette smoking. Perhaps that played a role in it. When I was 4, Sylvia gave me what was to be the first in a long line of presents, a tricycle that bore a metal label on its front shaft with the trademark Pioneer. As she had once told me that children in the Soviet Union called themselves pioneers, I considered that this tricycle was really something special. All the people in my family in those days had high expectations of the Soviet experiment. My Aunt Sylvia and Uncle Phil went to communist meetings, although they did not carry cards, and 3 other members of my mother's family actually went so far in their enthusiasm as to set sail for Russia to build the new Jewish SSR in Brobydgen. A move they were to bitterly regret later on, but that is another story. I waved goodbye to them as they set off on a large steamship. My mother and Sylvia and my uncles Phil and Jaime decided to stay on in America. America had been good to them. They had started out on the Lower East Side. When I was born, they all moved a step upward to Brooklyn. After the departure of those who had gone to build communism, they again moved upward in the social scale toward the sun and trees of the Bronx. It was in the Bronx that Sylvia was to meet the two men who were to play a decisive role in her life, Trotsky and Pappas. She followed Trotsky like an exalted lamb from one drafty meeting hall to the next, much to the disapproval of the rest of my family, who found Trotsky an eccentric, a spoilsport in their dream of Soviet socialism. As for Pappas, whom Sylvia had picked up in Trotsky's wake, he was not even one of us. Not Jewish, but a Greek, an un-thing even lower than an Italian. When he and Sylvia first began to live together, he worked as a dishwasher in a restaurant. But by the time I met him, he was blind. A policeman had hit him on the head with a club during a strike. In those days, such behavior on the part of policemen seemed quite ordinary. The apartment my parents had found was in a building by the park. It had signs of bourgeois dignity, such as a front garden with a statue, a long blue canopy leading to the entrance door, a large entrance hall paved in marble, and elevators. The color wine red predominated in our parlor. In the heavily stuffed sofa and armchairs, the deep imitation Persian rug, the heavy curtains at the windows that my mother referred to as the drapes. From this setting derived my sense of security, and perhaps even the bourgeois points of view I held in my childhood, despite my early daydreams of being a pioneer. For that matter, the local communists who lived in the adjoining, much less noble neighborhood of Allerton Avenue were enough to turn anyone off communism. They seemed to me as dogmatic and inflexible a lot as the few Orthodox Jews I had ever met. Amid the hard-bitten Stalinists who populated that hotbed of Reds, Sylvia and Pappas formed an ostracized Trotskyist island. Their apartment, high in the skies of Allerton Avenue, was a temple of free thought, or at least discussion, and I gravitated to it frequently out of natural preference. Their building had no pretensions to style. Their flat was on the sixth floor, and there was no elevator. The two rooms were hardly furnished. No attempt had been made to make them look cozy. The floors were bare. The only concession to luxury was a big radio, very important to Pappas, for he stayed home all the time, reading books in Braille and listening to Beethoven. Pappas could see a bit, shadows I suppose, so he did the housekeeping and cooking. The place, under his auspices, was bare, but always gave the impression of being sunny and spotlessly clean. Sylvia found a job clearing tables in a cafeteria on Allerton Avenue, a place that always smelled of hot, cheap tomato soup. One of her admonitions to me, delivered with an emphasis that had made me never forget it, was never stack glasses one inside the other. Because they may crack, I realize, from the intensity with which she delivered this warning, how stern her supervisor must have been. Pappas was a beautiful man. His home in Greece had been the Isle of Kos, where Hippocrates came from. Pappas looked like a Phidias statue that had acquired a strong suntan. Lying in the sun was his main occupation in the summertime. He was a real sun worshiper, always extolling the beneficial effects of the sun's rays and exhorting us to sunbathe with him on a blanket laid out on the flat tar-papered roof of their apartment house. He would chide me for my infantile prudery at not wanting to undo my blouse in such circumstances, which now makes me wonder how blind he really was. Sylvia never seemed to hold these long hours of leisure against him. Like some people appreciate beautiful horse flesh, she must have liked beautiful man flesh, and in this too she was un-Jewish. How a man looked was something nice women were supposed not to notice. They made a pretty couple, tiny red-headed Sylvia and her dark Greek athlete, the only pair of adults in my surroundings from whom the mind did not edge gingerly away when one thought of them having sex. I can see her now, Sylvia, standing on the linoleum in that bright kitchen, her eternal cigarette hanging from her lower lip, watching me gorge myself on the dish they called Greek salad, composed of all kinds of raw vegetables bathing in olive oil, so different from the steamed and stewed cooking I got at home. Pappas would jaw at me for hours on end in his Greek accent, more distinguished sounding than the Yiddish accents I usually heard, because he could pronounce the theta in my name. He would harangue me from a great store of autodidactic knowledge, raising problematies which I now realize had their origin in Plato, trying to teach me how to think, as he put it. But no matter on which subject we started, every conversation seemed to end in an indictment of the capitalist system. the capitalists. I can still see the scornful way his lips turned down when he said the word. Alas, his description of their doings were as gross as the caricatures of capitalists that used to figure in the Daily Worker, where capitalists were shown as fat men in striped pants and top hats, smoking big cigars and sitting atop bags marked with dollar signs. During this period, the Depression was in full swing. Of the few people who ever mustered the energy to climb the six flights of stairs was a Greek friend of theirs called Harry Cornelius, who had found a job inventing dance routines for nightclub chorus girls. I can still see his hard-bitten, lined Athenian features up above, while down below his pointed yellow shoes would be demonstrating a new tap dance step. Life in America forced people into strange, clownish disguises. Naively, in her hope to enrich all of us, honestly, by luck and by talent, and not through capitalism, Sylvia dreamed that I might cash in on the pretty little soprano voice I had developed. She would get me a permanent wave for my hair, put in a big satin bow. I would wear a fancy party dress and sing on an amateur show, where I would be discovered and become the new Deanna Durbin. But I resisted these plans. I did not care for the idea of becoming another Deanna Durbin, even to please Sylvia. She did not hold it against me. Now and then, to cement our friendship even further, Sylvia gave me a present. And as she was truly my soulmate, it was always something I really wanted. A silver bracelet, a pair of ice skates, a record player. More often than not, my mother made me give it back, on the theory that Sylvia was so poor, she could not be allowed to take from her pittance to give such expensive presents. The process of giving them back was mortifying for all concerned. I think my mother was jealous of my affection for Sylvia, and it may also have been her way of rubbing it in that Sylvia could have been as well off as the rest of the family, but had refused this. Yes, she was the outcast, the Jewish woman who did not wear the respectable matron's uniform of Persian lamb and diamond ring. Never would she have to go to the large-sized dress department in the big stores, and it would not be she who would attend Jewish weddings in black crepe dresses decorated with sequins around the collar. Earn money, flourish, raise children, display wealth, wear the mantle of dignity. All these values of Jewish life had not so much been spurned by my Aunt Sylvia as sidestepped. She was a beatnik avant la lettre, living in a manner that was two generations ahead of her time. If she had stayed on in Lukacs, she would have been a terrible misfit in that tight Jewish world, just as in the States she was a kind of misfit. But as the States are made of misfits, it didn't make any difference. I entered college, and while I was there, two important events occurred in the life of my Aunt Sylvia. One was that the eternal cigarette that had yellowed her fingers had also given her cancer of the lip. She had an operation, and after that she smoked no more. The other thing was that Pappas brought over his sister from Greece with money furnished by Sylvia. The sister settled down with some man in Yonkers. I never met the sister. While I was in college, I did not find much time for Sylvia either. As for Pappas, discussions with him had begun to bore me. In order to attack the capitalist system according to the Platonic dialectic, he needed an interlocutor who would agree to defend it. But I did not always feel like being pushed into that role. Besides, I discovered that there were other things in life beside the capitalist system, pleasant things like reading Chaucer, going to the opera, and running around with boys. My visits to the sunny flat grew fewer. Soon afterward, I left for Europe, for good as it turned out, where occasionally I would get an odd scrap of news about Sylvia from my father's letters. Finally, I learned that Papa's sister had left the man she had been living with and had moved into the High Love Nest on Allerton Avenue. According to what I knew of small group theory, this boded trouble, and so it was to be. When at last I returned to the States for a visit, I learned that just a few months before my arrival, Sylvia had left Pappas, never to return. There had been a terrible scene, in the course of which they said the kind of things that people can never more forgive. No doubt the presence of his sister made Pappas feel strong. Perhaps he had always hated Sylvia because he was dependent upon her. Now he and his sister were living companionably together on a small pension he received from the American Society for the Blind. Sylvia was no longer working in the cafeteria, I learned from my mother. There had been an accident. A heavily loaded serving trolley had smashed one of the fingers on her left hand. The nerve had been permanently damaged, or so Sylvia claimed, causing her excruciating suffering if anyone so much as breathed upon the finger in question. Her long yell of pain continued until she was awarded a life pension from the cafeteria's insurance company. Was there something, perhaps, odd about Sylvia's behavior in this affair? I suppose, as she saw it, the insurance company was a thing without a face, but its wealth was vast, and some of that wealth would be put to good use in freeing her from the smell of cheap tomato soup. I went to pay her a visit in her new place, a tiny hutch smack in the middle of the co-ops, the heartland of communism on Allerton Avenue. What had Papa said to her that had canceled their whole life together? I could not ask. Delicacy tied my tongue, and she did not offer. As for Pappas, I could never dare to visit him. He would surely have boasted about it to my Uncle Jaime, who used to see him now and then, in his status as surrogate paterfamilias, and Jaime would have relayed the news of my betrayal back to Sylvia, in the usual pattern in Jewish families of setting A against B. Had I grown taller, or had Sylvia shrunk? She was now so much smaller than I. When I hugged her, I realized that she had also become much thinner, really skinny. She had held the damaged finger upright with a great show of solicitude, lest it be included in the hug. Was this real, or had she learned her part so well that she played it even in private? That, no doubt, would be the best way to avoid detection. You never knew who might be a spy. Such were the mores that were prevailing in the co-ops. She tried to press food and drink upon me, but it was hot and I did not feel like having anything. Finally, she managed to tempt me with a melon. She cut it up into green, wet cubes and put them into a soup dish, and I sat there eating them with a fork, and we grinned at each other, pals as always. It was as if we had last seen each other only yesterday afternoon. Then she started trying to give me presents, as was her wont. Her tiny flat was encumbered with piles of unworn clothing that she had picked up cheaply at sales. She made me try some on, but it turned out that she had become two sizes smaller than me. So she pressed into my hands, because she said its message was important, a book called The History of the Great American Fortunes. She must have lots of time for reading now. Indeed, on her bedside, I saw some paperbacks, 4 short novels by Henry James, My Name is Aram by Sarayan, Dreiser's An American Tragedy. I suddenly realized, seeing those books, that in other circumstances she might have been a friend of mine. Why, she wasn't even 20 years older than me. Sadly, I observed that the bright copper hair I had so used to admired had gone dull, was full of strands of gray. What did she think now about her life, if she thought about it at all? Sylvia, a chip hurled up from the great forests of Russian faces, bored over the shores of America, to become a chip in the great forest of American faces, a nobody, a nothing, a sub-sub-proletarian who had a job in a cafeteria, not even as a waitress or a cook, but a cleaner of tables. A person of no account, a person who made no contribution, a mindless gnome, an insect. But she had lived according to her principles, a sort of Trotskyist nun among the worshippers of the golden calf, while the other members of my family, with their safe deposit boxes full of American tell-and-tell, had joined in the American game. No outsider looking at her would ever guess what a gallant fight she had fought against the crushing steamrollers of two cultures, merely in order to go her own way. Anyone who does not know her as I do will merely see a graying, wizened woman, a trifle weird, wearing a cotton t-shirt on her scrawny neck and fleshless arms. The industrial system had chewed her up and spat her out, and in old age, ultimate indignity, she was starting to look like Popeye. Yet this was once my dashing, my beautiful, my copper-haired Aunt Sylvia, of whose existence on Earth soon nobody would know but me.
On her face, says, my years bring me no disgrace.